The show is Stand to Reason, friends. Greg Kokel, your host, and glad to be with you here today. You know, I want to jump into this right away and give you, let you know where I'm going to be speaking in the next few weeks, because what happens is I forget to do it. I get involved in the show and the calls and talking with you, and then I forget it. So let me just mention very quickly that this coming weekend, Saturday, October 13th, and Sunday, October 14th, I will be at Bay Area Church in League City, Texas. I'm going to be talking about tactics. You know, I looked at my schedule, and it's not clear to me that I'm teaching on Sunday morning, but I know I'm going to be there Saturday for an all-day tactics conference. So League City, Texas, BayAreaChurch.com is the contact. I will be the following weekend in Maryville, Tennessee, and I have been there before. I wonder if it's the same church that I've been to in Maryville, Tennessee, River Oaks Community Church, and I'll be talking about tactics and the story of reality and no pixie dust and ambassadors for Christ and contend earnestly for the faith. And I got a lot of work that weekend, and that looks like a Friday, Saturday, Sunday event. Actually, the dates are October 19th through the 21st, so that would be over the whole weekend. And you can go to theroc.org, theroc.org. That would stand for River Oaks Community Church if you wanted to show up for that. And then the following weekend, last weekend of the month, October 26th, Friday through Sunday, October 28th, I'll be at Virginia Beach at Bay Lake UMC, and I'll be speaking on tactics and the story of reality and the intolerance of tolerance. So that would be vaumc.org. vaumc.org is the place for that information. Now, a few weeks back, maybe more than a month ago, I guess now, I told you about a fabulous magazine called Salvo. And Salvo is probably the most thoughtful Christian magazine I have ever seen. And it is written to, it's kind of like an apologetics magazine, but it's more elegant than that, in a sense. It's just not raw apologetics. But they have fabulous articles and reviews and interviews and all kinds of stuff. So a friend of mine is the publisher of that, who started it years ago. And if you wanted to find out more about the magazine itself, you can simply go to salvomag.com, S-A-L-V-O-M-A-G.com. So I encourage you to do that and subscribe, because it comes out, I think, four times a year. And here I have Salvo number 45, so it's been around for a while now. But I just found, in the last issue, I found so many articles that were really interesting to me. And here's one, actually there are two. One is a book review called Heretic. That is the view. The book is called Heretic, a review of the book called Heretic, One Scientist's Journey from Darwin to Design by Matt LeSola and Jonathan Witt. And there is a review there. And then there's also an article about the book. So there's a little bit of both here. And I want to talk about some of the things that I read there that you may find interesting. I love it when, in a certain sense, someone from the other side crosses over. That is, especially in the area of Darwinian evolution, which I reject on the merits themselves. I do not reject Darwinism, that is the macro evolution, neo-Darwinian synthesis. I don't reject it because I'm a Christian. Hey, I'm a Christian, I'm not supposed to believe that. Because there are a lot of Christians who do believe it. Now, I think they believe it in a way that creates problems for their Christianity. But I'm just letting you know that I'm not closing my eyes to science because I have a Bible that tells me to do so. I think Darwinism fails on the merits. And this is why it's so satisfying when someone who is steeped in that tradition makes a change, and makes a change principally because of the merits. That is, the reasons in favor of Darwinian evolution he realized are not persuasive, but in fact something else is going on to keep that paradigm alive, and that is actually two things in my view, and he does speak to it. It is the power of a paradigm that is driven principally by a philosophy, and that's the philosophy of materialism, and the power of a paradigm, I'm sorry, the power of a reigning paradigm, which that refers simply to the power of people in power who have the ability to cut off debate when it isn't going their way. And when he slowly became aware of both of those things, three things, which includes the problem with the merits of the case for Darwinism itself, that's when he decided eventually to jump ship. Now, part of his critique, let me just look at this because I want to get the right, the biochemist Matti Lesola, I guess is the way you pronounce it, because there are two authors here, but I think one is the writer helper and the other one's the academic. So Matti Lesola, he had dismissed the intelligent design model, let's put it that way. He had dismissed it because this was just simply another example of God of the gaps. That is, the way this objection is frequently characterized is that you guys just don't know what happened, and so you stick God in that gap of knowledge. Okay, that's what's called the God of the gaps. And what he came to realize at some point is that the God of the gaps criticism, this is one of the things that he realized that helped turn his mind around, is the God of the gaps criticism cuts both ways. Because a functional atheist could also insert their materialistic appeal or explanation in any knowledge gap. And this is exactly what happens. I hear it from Michael Shermer all the time, American Atheist, Skeptic Magazine, evolutionist, who says, in the face of daunting evidence against Darwinism, we'll say, and this is particularly at a couple of specific points, like the origin of life and then the development of life into different life forms. He'll simply say, why can't we just say we just don't know? Why can't we just say we just don't know? Now, there's an appeal there to the gap. We don't know. Okay, we don't need to put God in that gap. Why can't we just say we just don't know? And, of course, what he means is we just don't know now. Because he's convinced that we will know eventually, because eventually science will fill the gap with a naturalistic explanation, so there's no need to appeal to God. Now, here's the problem with that approach. First of all, it is guilty of what it is criticizing. It is criticizing a God of the gaps by replacing it with a science of the gaps. He's sticking a scientific question mark in there. He's sticking something in there to plug the hole. He doesn't know what it is, but he's sure that it's something naturalistic that will eventually be able to explain it. So this is just like Matti Lesola says, this God of the gaps criticism can cut both ways because the atheist is going to put his own thing in the gap, that is his faith in naturalism, okay? And that brings me to the second problem with this God of the Gaps appeal, is that this is circular. How is it circular? Circularity is when you're assuming what needs to be proved. Well, what are they assuming? They're assuming that the gap will be filled with some naturalistic explanation because there must be one. But, of course, that's the whole thing in question here, whether naturalistic explanations are adequate to explain everything. And when you look at some of these gaps, they seem to be so profound that even in principle, a naturalistic explanation is not going to be adequate. Yet if you assume naturalism, there must be one, then you can readily place that naturalistic question mark in the gap, meaning we don't know the naturalistic answer, but we do know there is one we will find eventually. So not only are they playing God of the Gaps in reverse, but they are also assuming what needs to be proved, that naturalism is adequate to fill every gap. But here's the third problem, is they're not just sticking G-O-D in a gap. In fact, the ID folk will say when it comes to these kinds of things, there is no gap. There's no gap of knowledge. We know, based on the existing evidence, what caused that thing. Because all of the evidence points to an agent who caused that thing. How do we know that? Because we know how agency works. You know why? Because we are ones. We are agents. And we know that certain things are the result of agents making decisions to act in a certain way and invent and build and develop things with know-how. That is, they use know-how to develop these things. We know how to recognize when something is so intricately fashioned that it requires know-how for it to function the way it functions. That means there is no gap of explanation. We have an explanation that is entirely adequate. It just doesn't fit the philosophy that is being forced upon us. There's another, and this is why, by the way, the point is made here that with regard to this book, Heretic, that there is a naturalistic evolutionary faith that is doing a lot of work. And by faith, I mean what they mean by faith. That means what you put your trust in something, you have no good reason to do it. It's not what I mean by faith. It's not what the Bible means by faith, but it's what the atheists define faith as, and that fits here. Because they are faith in a process that is not adequate to the task. There isn't evidence to show that the process they're having faith in can accomplish what they need it to accomplish. And one of those is massively the origin of life. And one of the points made here in the book Heretic, and again, I haven't read it, but I'm looking at the review, I'm seeing what is said about it, is that the knowledge gap is not shrinking. It isn't like all these gaps, what used to be big and we didn't know how it worked, and now we realize science, well, all of these gaps are shrinking. Well, many of them are, as we learn more, but there are certain gaps that are regular and systematic that are not getting smaller, they're getting larger because of the nature of the gap. And I just mentioned one of those, and that's the origin of life. You know, life, even its most simplest, is so massively complex. Every single cell is like a small city in its complexity and all the things that it does. And it is just not judicious to presume that all of these things happened by any kind of accident, but especially the accident of genetic mutation and natural selection. It's not adequate to do the job. And the more that we find out about these things, the bigger these gaps get, making, by the way, the agency explanation to fill the gap with an explanation, not a G-O-D word, to fill the gap, to bridge the gap with an explanation that fits the available evidence, why that is becoming more and more persuasive because it does such a good job and these other naturalistic gaps are growing growing by leaps and bounds. He makes another, in the article, there's another point that's made that is one that Alvin Plantinga has made, and it's an inherent difficulty, it might be called an external conceptual problem, to the Darwinian model. And that is, and here's the statement in the article, naturalism is destructive to science. Do you hear this? Naturalism is destructive to science. Now, that's the philosophy that guides the whole scientific enterprise right now. Naturalism is actually destructive to science, the claim goes, because it offers no basis for believing that we evolved to find correct answers. It offers no basis for believing that we evolved to find correct answers. You see, evolution does not select for truth. It selects for survivability, or more precisely, it selects for getting our selfish genes into the next generation most effectively. It's all it cares about. And it certainly is conceivable that there is some element in our development that causes us to believe something false, and that false belief is what helps us to get our genes in the next generation into the next generation more effectively. So Darwinism, selecting for survivability, generally speaking, and not for truth, raises a big question mark then about the process of our brains that allows us to come to the conclusion that Darwinism itself is true. How can we make sense? How can we trust a chance process that develops our brains and thinking to give us a reliable process to discover truth, especially when that chance process does not select for truth in the first place? That's the complaint being raised here, and that's the point that the well-known eminent philosopher over at Notre Dame University, Alvin Plantinga, has raised. I think C.S. Lewis raised something similar, a point like that. In any event, this scientist, Matty Lesola, in the process of not only looking at the evidence and realizing how much of the model, the Darwinian model, is being propped up by the power of a philosophic paradigm, naturalism, and seeing evidence to the contrary, this is what began to drive him to be a heretic to that point of view. A couple of thoughts here in the article that talk about the process. It says, Lesola and Witt leave us with, and I'm not sure who Witt is, to be honest with you. I'm looking here. I thought maybe the writer, maybe another scientist. In any event, they're co-authors here. Leave us with two thoughts to ponder. First, after writing 140 reviewed papers with over 5,000 citations, Lesola found that, quote, the more groundbreaking the science I did, the harder it became to get the work accepted. Close quote. That's not about ideas such, but about a certain loss of adventurousness in science generally, they say. Darwin isn't the only icon no one dare challenge. He is just the one best known to the average reader. Second, Lesola concludes, quote, I came to understand through my many international connections that neo-Darwinism, while little valued among mainstream biologists who spend any time thinking about the theory, was treated by them all as a third rail, too dangerous to touch, close quote. So I'm glad for people like this, because what they are saying more and more is that, first, this is something that, on the merits, the point that I started with, doesn't have the chops to stand up on its own. But because of a power play grounded in a philosophic paradigm, naturalism, the paradigm of Darwinism is not allowed to be challenged. It's protected. Why does it need to be protected? Because it can't stand up on its own. Or as Richard Lewontin said famously in the New York Review of Books a number of years ago, he's a Harvard geneticist and obviously a Darwinist, we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. and that's what it's all about. It's about philosophy. It's not about following the evidence where it leads, they point out here in this book. It's about the power of a paradigm. And I have asked many times, do you want the right answers or do you want the right kinds of answers? And that's the question I think any scientist in this field has to struggle with. Do you want the right answers, that is, the facts of how this actually took place, without just dismissing things because you don't like it, or you want to call it religion rather than science? If the scientific methodologies are in place, if the points of view are well justified, it shouldn't matter whether it is a naturalistic answer or not. So do you want the right answers, or do you demand the right kinds of answers, those answers that comport with naturalism, materialism, and physicalism? That's the question. All right. To your calls in just a few moments. You're listening to Stand to Reason.
Would you like Greg, Alan, or Tim to come speak at a location near you? If so, just send a quick email to darcy@str.org to schedule them today. Our speakers are accomplished and compelling presenters who address, from a biblical standpoint, topics like abortion, homosexuality, and evolution, as well as apologetics, theology, and evangelism. They're available to teach lectures and seminars, preach sermons, and lead workshops at single events or weekend-long conferences. Their aim is to help Christians like you effectively engage the culture around you with knowledge, wisdom, and character. To learn more, just go to str.org and click on the training tab at the top of the page.
You know, if you've gained anything from listening to Stand to Reason, I'd really be thrilled to hear it from you. I love to take your questions, of course, but I also want your feedback. So here's what you can do. Head over to iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave us a rating and a review. That kind of thing really helps us to get the word out so more ambassadors for Christ can find the show and become equipped to stand confidently. And you never know, I might just give you a shout out on the air to show you my appreciation for your positive review. I value you as a faithful listener. I look forward to reading what you think about the show. Thanks. Yes, oh yes. Amy Hall has asked me to remind you that if you want to listen to the STR Ask podcast, you have to search for #STRASK, all one unit. No spaces allowed. Okay. Is this case sensitive, Amy? She doesn't think so, but yes, people have had trouble finding it because I haven't been clear about the nomenclature, so there you have it. And I'd love to have you. If you enjoy this show, you will enjoy Amy and I mixing it up with questions that you send in on Twitter to #STRask, and we do two episodes a week, shorter, 20 to 25 minutes, and knock some things around, and you get to benefit from Amy's insight, wisdom, knowledge, sense of humor. No, she's not that funny. My sense of humor with Amy. She's great. You'll enjoy it. Okay, let's go back to phones, and I have to thank Peter here for waiting so long in Leander, Texas. That's Brian, rather. About Peter. Brian, welcome to the show. Hi.
Hello, Brother Coco. Good to talk with you again.
Thank you, and thank you for your patience.
Last spring at Rethink in Dallas.
Oh.
It was good talking with you then as well.
Thank you. Thank you. And I appreciate your long patience here today.
Yes, sir. No worries.
What can I help you with, Peter? I keep saying the same thing. Brian, I know I can help you with Peter. Okay, you go ahead. Tell me about Peter, Brian.
Okay, so I've got all your I just recently got all your ABC courses, and I'm thoroughly enjoying them. And I believe I've listened to like all 15 of them, so I can't pinpoint which exactly one you do say it. I think it's in the one about the will of God.
Uh-huh.
Where you talk about how basically if God talks to people today, it's going to be undeniable. And I don't know if you directly say it, but I think that you push that God doesn't really speak through us like with our thoughts.
Well, here's what I just for clarification, I never talk about God. I always talk about the Bible. So
right.
God can do whatever he wants, but we have to look at what we expect God to do comes from the teaching of Scripture. And so when people communicate that everyone can have essentially a conversational relationship with God where we talk to God and God talks to us in some way, or some will refer to listening prayer, my point is none of that is taught in the Bible. And not it isn't taught that we all can have that, and that the occasions that God actually does intervene to give a specific directive to anybody are rather rare, and when they happen as an intrusion into the circumstance in a supernatural way that cannot be mistaken. And I characterize virtually every single occasion of that in the book of Acts because it does follow that pattern. Okay, so that's the backdrop to your question. Right.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay.
And so and I do agree with you because I do see those biblical examples that, like you pointed out, like in your, I think in the video that you recently put out, like when God met Saul, who was later Paul, it was very, he was blinded,
right,
for 3 days and all that. But my question was, it does seem like it wasn't that intrusive in Matthew 16 when Jesus is asking the disciples, hey, who do men say that I am?
Right.
And they said, John the Baptist, Isaiah, or they name a few of the prophets. And then Peter says, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God.
Uh-huh.
And Jesus said, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, because flesh and blood hasn't delivered to you, but my Father who is in heaven.
Right.
And so you don't...
There's no voice from heaven, right.
There's no... It doesn't seem like Peter got that from an audible voice.
Correct.
It seems like it was something was going on inside his spirit. And then later, at the same, just 12 verses later, then Peter tells Jesus, hey, you're not going to go to the cross. We're not going to allow that to happen. And he says, get thee behind me, Satan. So you have God and both Satan in like one chapter communicating with Peter.
Right.
They don't seem to be like... where everybody else can see that they're communicating.
Sure. Okay, yes. I can see the reason you have the question in light of what I said just a few moments ago. So let me see if I can clarify here. What you said just a moment ago is you have God and Satan communicating to Peter. I don't think they were communicating to Peter in the sense that we normally think of the word communicate. Because communicate is a process of passing information on somewhat directly. So I'm communicating to you right now. So I'm using words to communicate very precise things, okay? I think rather what was going on here is that, and I got to be careful how I say this, there was an influence, certainly in the case of Satan, an influence of Satan on Peter with regards to these ideas, and prior to that, an influence of the Father that Jesus actually calls revelation. God is, after a fashion, and God is not, man has not revealed this to you, but the Father. So I don't think this is a communication in the standard way we think of communications or any of the other communications I mentioned in the book of Acts, where there's a direct kind of thing, but rather a working, in the first case, of the Father in the life of Peter to be aware of a truth. I don't deny that at all. I think God is working that kind of thing in people all the time. But notice that Peter didn't think that God told him anything. He didn't say, I think the Father is telling me thus and so, that you're the Christ. No, this was an awareness and a conviction that he had inside.
I'm sorry.
That's right.
Would you say that conviction was promoted by thoughts that was inspired by the Father?
Say that again. Was that conviction what?
Would you say that conviction what you term as conviction, would you say that conviction was inspired by thoughts of the Father? And I do think that you made a good point that Peter didn't recognize that it was God the Father. But do you think that Peter came to that conviction, that revelation, via thoughts that were inspired by the thoughts.
Well, it was expressed in thoughts, but the conviction, I don't think, was a thought. I don't think he had the thought, oh, Jesus is the Christ. Oh, okay. Hey, you're the Christ. I don't think it happened that way. I thought he was persuaded that Jesus was the Christ. I don't think he got information right there. I think that he knew that Jesus was the Christ. In fact, there are other times when he said things like this. You know, in John chapter 6, the disciples leave him, Jesus, many do, masses do, after the Bread of Life discourse, and Jesus said, are you guys going to go too, to the closer group of disciples? And Peter says, where are we going to go? You have the words that bring eternal life. Okay, so there was a kind of veiled confession of a similar sort even there. Okay, what Jesus is simply saying here is not that that Peter has developed the ability to intuit and pick up the vibes that the Father is putting out. He's nothing like that. What Jesus is saying is this conviction that you have, this insight, this knowledge, this thing that you're standing by, this confession that you made, you know where you got that? You didn't get that from man. You got that from God. And that's true of every single person who believes that Jesus is the Christ. We get that from God. We don't get that from ourselves. This is something the Holy Spirit communicates to us.
And a secondary question with that is, in one of your teachings, I've listened to a lot of your teachings lately, but in one of your teachings, you brought out how you do believe that the gifts are still operable, although they're not that common, but you've seen like the word of knowledge used where something was brought out into the light because that person didn't bring it out beforehand to God in the light. So that's why you believe that the word of knowledge was used in that.
Yeah, right. I don't have any good theological reason to believe that the so-called supernatural gifts are no longer operating. So
yeah,
I'm certainly open to that.
And so
that's a different feature. That's a different issue than the one we've been talking about.
Well. My secondary question, I do kind of think that it correlates in that the word of knowledge, and I've read like books of people who, you know, and who knows whether they're really using that or not. People who claim to be used in that, and I've read books of people and said that, and they said that most of the time the word of knowledge came to them via thoughts.
Yeah. Well, the word of knowledge is propositional, so it would have to be a thought when it's in somebody's mind. They have to form
right.
It as a thought, okay? So I don't know the whole phenomenology of that for people who operate in those areas. I'm just saying with regards to Matthew 16 that Peter had a conscious conviction and awareness that could be formed as a proposition regarding who Jesus was. And Jesus is simply saying that this conviction that you have, this understanding, finds its source in the Father's action in Peter's life. That's all the point that he's making. And later on, when he says, oh, no, Jesus, you're not going to go to the cross, then Jesus said, oh, that's a different source now that's trying to weasel its way in here, and this is Satan, and he's going to put that down right away.
Right. And I know we can't limit God, but you would I just want to make sure I'm understanding your perspective on it totally.
Uh-huh.
You would say that normally God doesn't speak to us in thoughts outside of like impressions when we read his word and things like that. But
no, I haven't made any commitments regarding that. You know, if God is going to influence us in our lives, probably through the person of the Holy Spirit, whatever God is doing, if he's going to influence our convictions in any way, and I think he does, those convictions are propositional by nature. They can be expressed in propositions, and so therefore they entail our thoughts, you know, and our beliefs. A thought is a way of holding or expressing a belief. And so these are things that God certainly has access to in our minds. What I am not trying to disqualify the work of the Holy Spirit in our lives to educate us, to inform us, to build up our understanding of Jesus or anything else about the spiritual life. I am speaking specifically to the claims that people make when they say, God told me this, that, or the other thing, or having the idea that the way we have to live our life is we make decisions by trying to figure out what God is trying to tell us to do. That is a very different thing than what seems to be going on here in Matthew 6, at least in my view. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, I understand. And I appreciate you taking time to talk about this with me.
All right. Well, it's great talking to you, too, and I hope that helped you out. What do you think?
Yes, sir. God bless.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Okay, let's go to an early break here, and we'll take our final callers right after that. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason.
Are you looking for a way to be more involved in the STR community? When you choose to support Stand to Reason with a monthly gift of $10 or more, you become a strategic partner in the work of equipping Christian ambassadors. Your monthly commitment makes you a part of a special group helping STR-trained Christians to graciously defend classical Christianity and classical Christian values. Your monthly gift helps us plan and manage STR's resources and provides consistent support to aid our planning and ongoing work. As a strategic partner, you'll enjoy an automatic 10% discount in our online store, access to a private Facebook group, and bi-monthly insider updates, so you'll get the inside scoop on what's going on in the ministry, and you'll know what you can pray for. Become a strategic partner in the Stand to Reason community today by visiting str.org/donate. Click How Often Will You Donate? And choose Monthly. For personal assistance, you can email ocean@str.org. That's ocean@str.org.
You can take Stand to Reason with you through our mobile apps, available for free from the App Store or the Google Play Store. The Quick Reference app gives you short, easily accessible courses on our most popular topics like tactics, homosexuality in the Bible, morality, the story of reality, and many more. The Stand to Reason app has all our latest content available at your fingertips. You can listen to our podcasts, check the blog, and access timely and practical resources. They're free, so download the apps today on the App Store or the Google Play Store and start carrying Stand to Reason with you everywhere you go. If you enjoy our apps, you can help other people find them by rating them on the App Store or the Google Play Store.
All right, in the stretch here. Final segment on this episode. Is that what it is? Do we do episodes? This episode of Stand to Reason. And in Grand Forks, North Dakota, Tyler. See, that's nice when we know the city they're from. Thank you, Amy. Grand Forks, Tyler, welcome to the show. Hi.
Thank you, Craig. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You're coming
through loud and clear.
I've got kind of a short version of my question, which I'll present to you, and if you want kind of the longer version, you can just let me know.
All right.
So, my question relates to the human anatomy regarding voluntary and involuntary muscles.
Uh-huh.
So, the question is a voluntary response evidence of free will?
I'm looking at the note that Amy put up, and she says, is it a voluntary Merkel? Did you write that, Amy?
Right, so...
Amy's my...
Go ahead.
I can't... It's M-U-R-C-L... Look, you can look at it later.
Muscle.
She's my editor, and she gives me Merkel. See? That says Merkel. Okay, I'm right and you're wrong. All right, now... Oh, it's a sloppy S. This is such a sloppy S, it looks like an R. Okay, fine. Got it. My answer to your question, your fine question, which I have never been asked before, is yes, that's what it means to be voluntary. A voluntary response is when you volunteer it, so to speak. A volunteer is someone who steps up and says, I will do this, though I don't have to. That's what a volunteer is, right? Unless you're in the Army, then you volunteer when you have to, you know, kind of we're forcing you to volunteer. But, yeah, I think it is. I think this is when agency is the thing that makes the event happen. If you think of it this way, there are two types of causes, what it is that makes something take place. One is called an event cause, one domino hits another domino, hits another domino. So you've got the event of the domino hitting one domino that causes it to fall to hit another domino. That's mechanical, all right? So you've got event causing event causing event causing event. And then you have agency. You notice if you think of all those dominoes, in order to get dominoes falling, someone has to flip the first domino, right? And then they start falling. So an agent initiates a causal chain or a series of events. And that is a voluntary action. That's what it means to be an agent. You could have done otherwise, but you voluntarily did that. So you have your autonomous nervous system in which you are not making a decision to respond. You don't decide to breathe, you know, for the most part. Sometimes you decide to, I'm going to take a deep breath, and so there's a little bit more conscious effort down in there. But most of the time, that's all happening automatically. Those are all dominoes falling that you can interrupt if you want. You could hold your breath. You could pant if you were going to make a scene about something. For the most part, the breathing happens without you thinking about it. So those are all event causation enterprises. So I do think that's a good way of distinguishing between event and agent causation, where you have an involuntary and a voluntary response of a muscle.
Right.
Of a Murphy.
Yeah, I agree with you. I actually only think that a voluntary response, a true voluntary response, is only possible in a world where an immaterial self exists.
Yes, I agree with that.
But physicalism and materialism doesn't allow for an immaterial self, which means the body dictates everything and everything we do, regardless if the actions are voluntary or involuntary.
So, well, it would be something physical, not necessarily. It could be something outside of the body influencing the body. So
okay.
Something physical, though. You're on the right track.
Right. So it just it seems ironic because, you know, I was just reading. I'm not huge into human anatomy or whatever. I work in the healthcare system, so It just sort of came up today. I was thinking about it. But,
right.
Yeah, I looked at the definitions as well, and the definition for voluntary muscles or response is those that are which under conscious control, which means under the control of the somatosensory nervous system. And I'm thinking, what's voluntary about that definition that we're under control of the somatosensory nervous system?
Yeah,
that seems not, like that's just another part of the body
of
that
course.
Voluntary muscles report to, but like that doesn't explain what's controlling the somatosensory system.
Exactly right.
In the material self aspect. Yeah.
No, I think you're exactly right. And there has to be a self behind that, or else it's just a series of events. It's back to the domino illustration. It's just a complicated series of dominoes falling, but it's dominoes nonetheless. And then no domino decides to do anything. It just gets hammered by the one before it and falls into the one after it. And on that view, you always have to ask yourself, you can legitimately ask yourself, what was the prior domino that caused this sensory domino to fall? And this is where they have to go, because there's no other place to go if you're a physicalist. It is dominoes all the way down. And then what it ends up resulting in is there are no free actions of any kind, which, by the way, there are a number of atheists that readily admit this. The late Stephen Hawking said this in his book, The Grand Design. And when I wrote a piece on that book a number of years ago, you can find it on our website, str.org, I asked the question, who got the royalties for that book? And why? If all that was going on in the writing of the book was dominoes falling, physics was everything. That was a claim he made in the book. And who chose the order of the words in the book? And if it was just dominoes falling, why did they happen to be largely grammatically correct? How did they conform to an outside set of conventions? I never thought of this point before, but I did think about who chose the order of the words of the book. I have that in the article. But notice how the order of the words in the book follow an external set of conventions that we call grammar. And they're conventions. They're made-up rules that help us to have understanding of a particular language. And the grammar for different languages is different. So how is it that these dominoes falling happen to create something as organized as a book, words, letters making words, words making sentences, sentences making paragraphs, and the whole thing making chapters and a book that conforms to a set of external standards, conventions called grammar, and audaciously claims to be true, giving accurate information about the world? Look at, if you take a bunch of Scrabble pieces, okay, and you dump them on the floor, is it ever legitimate to say that any of those Scrabble pieces ever spelled a word?
It's possible, but not probable.
Well, I'm making a more refined point here. Yes, it could be that the letter T-O-E fall next to each other. Now, if a human were to put that there, they would be communicating a meaning through a word. So it would be a type and a token. The type would be the meaning. The token would be T-O-E. Okay? But if you do it by accident, even if those letters fell together, they wouldn't actually be a word because there's no... It's not representing a type that's being communicated because there's no mind involved, is my point. So if the world is just, like Sam Harris says, also one of the new atheists, who also writes books that conforms to to the conventions of grammar, and he also gets a royalty for what he did, he says there's no freedom. But it makes no sense in light of his activities themselves. And the fact that his activities communicate information that he thinks is true to the way the world really is, that seems to me to be an argument against the determinism he advances in his own books. In fact, yep. I think it's not only convincing or compelling, it's definitive argument against it. But this stuff doesn't occur to people, you know. So,
right.
Yeah, I think you're on the right track there.
Okay. All right. Appreciate it.
All right. Yeah, Tyler, I appreciate your call. It was nice. I like talking about that stuff. And it just mystifies me how these atheists, and I heard two of them talking once on a podcast, well-known atheists, maybe Sam Harris was one of them, and they're both saying, yeah, we're determined. Doesn't bother me at all. I can do whatever I want, even though I'm determined. Huh? Anyway, I don't think they're being careful. I think that they're saying what sounds good to them and saves their paradigm. Because they don't want a soul. A soul is invisible. It's immaterial. It doesn't comport with materialism. They don't want top-down soul governing body. That doesn't fit with their worldview. So they're going to say something ridiculous. Consciousness is an illusion. Huh? What, really? What's an illusion? Isn't an illusion when your consciousness is being appeared to falsely? So if your consciousness is an illusion, then what is having the illusion of consciousness? It's got to be another consciousness. So is an illusion having an illusion? That's my point. Non-conscious things do not have illusions. Pretty straightforward. All right. All right, let's go to Arkansas. And Steve, hey, Steve, welcome to the show.
Oh, hello there, Greg.
Hello there, sir. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. I'm a transplant from Southern California.
Oh, okay.
It's been a long time since I heard you, but I used to listen to you when I was there.
Oh, but, that was when I was at KBRT, my flag station, early on, probably.
Yeah.
Well, nice. Yeah.
Well, you know, here's the question. It's been on my mind here ever since one of my Sunday school class. He's actually the leader of the class. He went to that ark in Kentucky, and Ken Ham.
Uh-huh.
And anyway, I just took the flood being global for granted, never researched it, and the ark also, and then anyway, it came to my attention, and so I went online there, and I saw that debate between Ken Ham and Bill Nye, the science guy, and...
Oh, yeah, that didn't go well for Ken, unfortunately. We prayed for him at our staff meeting, by the way, for Ken, but it just didn't go well, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, I think he's done a disservice for science trying to prove the flood and everything. I think when you look at all the science that shows the impossibility of a global flood, and I'm not saying that I have to believe there's a global flood, because I know there's that physicist there in California who believes it was a local flood, and he uses physics to explain most of his
theory. Well, you know what, you don't even need, you just need physics. You can just do it with the scripture, because I'm looking right now at Genesis 8, and this is where the flood subsides. I am not convinced in any sense that the Genesis account of the flood requires a global flood. Now, I don't really have a horse in this race, although I'm leaning much more towards a local flood, which the Bible describes as the world that then was. First, 2 Peter chapter 3. In other words, the world, the inhabited world, which was the world that was under judgment, human beings were meant to be destroyed, that world was destroyed. So the flood, the extent of the flood only covered those that were to be destroyed, and they were inhabiting that region, had not been spread out yet. Because remember, this is before the Tower of Babel incident in Genesis 11. So people were pretty much localized there, and the judgment was upon all of the population of the world. And even as I look in chapter 8, I see universal language being used clearly of localized things. This is true in other texts, and I see it here. First, in verse 5 of chapter 8, it says, "The water decreased steadily until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains became visible." Okay, so therefore, there isn't water over all the land there, right, anymore? Verse 5? You with me?
I'm
sorry, I didn't mean to catch you by surprise.
I'm listening to you, but I'm not following you on your...
Okay, well, I'm just making the point that in verse 5 of chapter 8, as the water begins to subside, the text says the tops of the mountains became visible. But then he sends the dove out. He sent out a dove, verse 8, to see if the water was abated from the face of the land. But the dove found no resting place for the sole of her foot, so she returned him in the ark, for the water was on the surface of all the earth. So it says in verse 5, the tops of the mountains were visible, even though in verse 9, after he sends the dove out, it says that the water was on the surface of all the earth. Now, either we have to qualify the meaning of those words, or at least all the earth, or else this is a direct contradiction within four verses of each other. I don't think there's a contradiction. I think the tops of the mountains are visible to Noah, but all of the earth that was accessible to the dove was covered with water, and that's why the dove couldn't land, which shows that these words are sometimes used in a qualified sense, and they are not to be taken as universal, even though the phrase says the surface of all of the earth in verse 9. So I'm very comfortable with a local flood in that region that killed all the people save 8, and that saved and the who are in the ark, and the ark saved the other animals that need in that area that needed to be saved. And I think that takes away a whole lot of problems that, unfortunately, a guy like our young earth friend I'm drawing a blank now. Ken Ham. Ken Ham is strapped with. I don't have those problems because I don't take the reading he takes.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think he makes some statements that are highly improbable. Like, you know, I don't know if you believe the, dinosaurs were... Are you a young Earth or old Earth?
No, I'm an old Earth, and I do not think that dinosaurs were contemporaneous with human beings.
Yeah, well, I mean, he believes there were baby dinosaurs on the, and he shows them on his...
sure, I understand. Well, if there were dinosaurs alive, they could put baby dinosaurs on the Ark. That wouldn't be a problem. But I just don't think that they were alive at that time. That's all. So we have a different view on that in general.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have been reading some science on this that seems to point out numerous other problems. And I would be okay with the
local,
the localized.
Flight. Yeah, and I'm with you on this. And I don't, to be honest with you, Steve, I don't really know what's at stake here for a person like Ken Ham. Now, he might want to say, well, I'm just trying to let the Bible speak for itself. But as I pointed out, the Bible is equivocal on this point. Sometimes universal language is clearly used to describe localized things. And with it, we find this in other kinds, other passages as well. And then when I look at this passage here, it says the water was on the surface of all the earth, verse 9, chapter 8, but four verses before it says the tops of the mountain were visible. So there's got to be a way of understanding how both of these verses work together without a contradiction. And I take it he's talking about on the face of all the earth that was accessible to the dove. There's no problem with that. I don't know why they have to cling to this other view, because especially if it creates problems for them scientifically and then they're ridiculed for it. I don't know what's at stake. Young Earth, I can see what might be at stake there for them theologically, whatever, but I don't see here with the global flood. Anyway, thank you so much for your call, Steve. Thanks for holding on so long to be part of our show. And that's it, friends. Thank you so much for you being part of our show. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye.